We're continuing our study of the doctrine of the Trinity in history and scripture. The first lecture was on the introduction, and then we also dealt with the Trinity, the doctrine of the Trinity, up until the Council of Nicaea in 325. My main point there was just to show that the doctrine of the deity of Christ in particular was not something that was created out of whole cloth at the Council of Nicaea, but it was something that the church always held, even prior to that point. Then in the second lecture, we talked about Arius and the Council of Nicaea itself, and we talked about the whole controversy with Arius and what Arius taught. He taught that the Son did pre-exist, but he didn't pre-exist eternally. And so therefore, he was the first creature that God made, maybe the most glorious creature, the firstborn of all creation, but still a creature. And the Council of Nicaea said no. The Council of Nicaea said that he's eternally begotten of the Father and that he is of the same substance, using that technical Greek phrase, homoousios. Homo means the same. Ousios means substance or essence. So saying that the Son has the same essence as the Father means that all that the Father is, the Son is. So that the Son shares in the full ontological deity of the Father. So today is our third lecture, and it's on the topic of Athanasius against the world. And just to let you know, I've basically gleaned a lot of my information from a volume in the series called The Nicene and Post-Nicene Fathers, second series. The fourth volume is dedicated to the writings of Athanasius, but it also has a lot of biographical information in the introduction, written by a theologian from the Church of England named Archibald Robertson. I don't know much about him, but he did a good job of compiling all of the historical data, and so that's where I've gotten a lot of my information from. So let's just go through the life of Athanasius. Athanasius was born in the year 297 or so. There's a question mark. It might have been 296. It might have been 298. So we'll just call it even and say 297. He was born to a Christian family in the city of Alexandria, which is in northern Egypt. He was raised in the church. When he was a boy, he was playing church. I don't know if any of your kids have done that. Pretending to do church, right? And he was pretending to be a bishop, and he was pretending to baptize some people and so on. And the true bishop of the Church of Alexandria, his name was Alexander, he saw this happening, and he concluded that it was a proof that Athanasius was called to go into the ministry. And so, quote, this is one of those statements from that author Archibald Robertson that I mentioned before. He says, "Young Athanasius was handed over to the bishop to be brought up like Samuel in the temple of God." So he basically, his whole life was dedicated to the church and to Christ. Just a little bit about his background. He was an Egyptian by nationality, and so that means that he was dark and swarthy, and he was even short, so his enemies had an epithet for him. They said, they called him the Black Dwarf. So that's what he looked like. That was his background, his ethnic background. As far as his level of education, he was taught on the basics of classical education. So at this time in the 4th century AD, most people who were from a wealthy background would be taught all of the classics, you know, Homer and Plato and so on. He did receive an education in that, but not very deeply. His education was more biblical than it was philosophical. And I've actually read some of his Greek. His Greek is very plain. I've read the flowery stuff, Plato and so on. His Greek is very simple. It's not all this advanced, highfalutin, philosophical, flowery stuff. It's very straightforward. He was really immersed in the scriptures. That was really the basis of his thinking and his theology. He did not know Hebrew, however, and he quoted the Old Testament in the Greek translation called the Septuagint. His writings are not philosophical or speculative, as is accused. Many people accuse him of that. they accuse, oh, Athanasius and these Trinitarians, they just are doing Greek philosophy. And they came up with all these fancy ideas about Trinity and ousia and homoousia and all this stuff. No, no, no. Athanasius was rooted in the scriptures. That's really what he was raised on. Gregory Nazianzen, who lived a little bit later, he said that Athanasius meditated on every book of the Old and New Testament with a depth such as none else has applied even to one of the books of the Old and New Testaments. So that's his background, his upbringing. In the year 318, we mentioned last week, was when the troubles with Arius began. Arius was a presbyter in the Church of Alexandria who began teaching this false doctrine about the Son being a creature and that there was a time when he did not exist. So that's when the controversy with Arius starts. In 319, Athanasius is ordained as a deacon in the Church of Alexandria. So his ordination, that's the first step. You know, he became a deacon, then a presbyter, then a bishop. His first ordination took place right around the time when all this is going on with Arius. And in the same church, in the same region. In 325, he attended the Council of Nicaea, but not as a bishop. He was still a deacon. And so he attended the council as the assistant to the bishop, who was Alexander. Now, from this point on, we outline, this is not just my own idea, this goes back to one of the earliest biographical writings about Athanasius. We basically break down his life into these alternating periods of the quiet periods and the exiles. Okay, he was exiled 5 times, but in between are the quiet periods. So we begin now with his first quiet period, which lasts for 7 years from the year 328 to 335. So in the year 328, 3 years after the Council of Nicaea, Alexander, the Bishop of Alexandria, died, and Athanasius was elected to be bishop in his place. At first, he was reluctant to take it on because he knew that there was going to be a lot of problems, not only with the Arian controversy, but there was another controversy too in the Church of Alexandria that we'll talk about later called the Milician Schism, which was basically a group of Christians that didn't accept the authority of the bishop and wanted to have their own church and their own bishop and so on. And so he knew that it was going to be tough to pastor this church. It's a big city, too. Alexandria is one of the most populous cities of the Roman Empire at the time. Millions of residents and, you know, a lot of them.
The 5 patriarchies.
That's right. One of the patriarchies. So you got Rome, you've got Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And Alexandria was one of the most important ones because it was so populous and there were so many Christians living there. There were also a lot of pagans still living there who worshiped the old Greek and Roman gods. And there were also a large population of Jews. This is the Jewish population in Alexandria is very ancient. It goes back hundreds of years. So it was a very populous city and a city that was tumultuous, that rioted a lot, and had lots of problems because of these religious controversies. And so Athanasius was reluctant, but he was entreated to do it, and he was ordained as the bishop in the year 328. He would serve as bishop until his death in the year 373, and so that means he served as bishop for 45 years. 17 of those years were spent in exile. On 6 different occasions, he had to flee for his life, because people were trying to kill him. And that's why he's called Athanasius contra mundum. Just means Athanasius against the world. So that's the first quiet period for about 7 years. Then in the year 335, we have his first exile. So from 335 to 337 is the first exile. It happened under the reign of Constantine. Remember, we talked about the conversion of Constantine last week. He was exiled to Trier in Gaul. Gaul is basically what would become France, but at this time it's called Gaul. And he was there for about 2 years. How did this happen? Well, in the year 335, there was a council called the Council of Tyre that was presided over by a fellow named Eusebius of Nicomedia. Now, Eusebius of Nicomedia is not to be confused with Eusebius of Caesarea. Eusebius of Caesarea was the guy who wrote the story of the conversion of Constantine. He wrote the first church history. Eusebius of Caesarea was somewhat aligned with the Arian group and was sympathetic to them, but he was not a full-on Arian the way Eusebius of Nicomedia was. Eusebius of Nicomedia held to the exact same views of Arius. It's interesting, too, at this point, we think of Arius as being the arch-villain. He's the big guy, right? But actually, he's the one that kind of prompted the controversy, but after a while, he sort of fades from history. He dies in the year 336. It's really this guy here, Eusebius of Nicomedia, who takes the flag and really pursues the controversy. Eusebius of Nicomedia died in the year 341, and that's important because he was succeeded by another fellow who kind of took his place as the head of the Arian faction. He was the bishop of the eastern imperial capital. There were different imperial capitals at this time. Like there was one, actually I think Trier was one of them in the west, but the one in the east was Nicomedia, which was in northwestern Turkey, not that far from Constantinople. Constantine was in the process of building Constantinople at this time, so it wasn't until he finished building it that Constantinople took over to become the eastern capital. But for a while, Nicomedia was the capital. There was also a large imperial residence in Nicomedia. So that made this bishop, Eusebius, the bishop of that city, a very important bishop. That means he had ties with the imperial court, and he had influence with the emperors. He was the most fervent supporter and defender of Arius and Arius' theology. He was the leader of the Arian conspiracy. Interestingly, Constantine, even though he was converted around the year 312, and we talked about that whole conversion experience with the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, he delayed his baptism until his death, probably because he thought, you know, I might commit some more sins, especially as an emperor, right, where you have to kill people and things like that. So I'll wait until my deathbed. So on his deathbed, he was baptized, but guess who baptized him? It was this guy, Eusebius of Nicomedia, which is very interesting. Not that Constantine himself was an Arian, but you could see how there's these ties and connections. I mentioned also in the year 336, just before Constantine died, Constantine attempted to get Arius restored back into the church. He had been excommunicated at the Council of Nicaea, but Constantine was convinced that Arius had repented and that he was Orthodox now, although other bishops had doubts about that and weren't convinced that he really was changing his views. And so Constantine was pressuring the bishops to restore him. In fact, there's this one dramatic occasion where the bishop of Constantinople was, you know, sweating over what to do because communion was going to be the next day, and the emperor is saying, you got to give him communion, and he didn't know what to do, and then guess what? Arius dies the day before on the toilet, you know, and so like this, it was viewed as being the judgment of God upon Arius and delivering the church from this catastrophe that almost happened. Then Constantine dies in the year 337. Again, remember, Athanasius is still in exile. He's over in the west, in Gaul. But when Constantine dies, something very important happens. Now, I just need to back up here and just say, this whole period of time in the 4th century, which is the 300s AD, is an incredibly complicated and tumultuous time. Not only in the church, because of all this controversy over Arius, but also in the political realm, in the Roman Empire. There's a lot of changes going on. There's all kinds of battles. There's people vying for power. There's usurpers who try to become the emperor, and then they end up losing out. And just this crazy time when all these weird things are happening. So in the process of telling you about the story of Athanasius and his life, I also have to tell you a little bit about what's going on in the empire, because it's all intertwined together. So Constantine had three sons. And after he died, these three sons, Constantine II, who was the oldest, Constantius II, and Constans, the youngest, they decided to divide the empire three ways among them. However, Constantine II thought that he, as the eldest, deserved a larger portion. So he invaded the region allotted to his brother Constans, the youngest, to try to get some more land for himself, and he ended up, Constantine II, ended up being killed in battle in the year 340. And that meant now you have two sons. You have Constantius and Constans, and they're going to duke it out for 10 more years until Constans dies, and then Constantius will become the sole emperor. And that's important because, as we'll see as we get into the story, Constantius, the second son of Constantine, is an Arian. Not like his father. His father may have been baptized by an Arian, but he wasn't committed to Arianism. Constantius was. He was committed to that philosophy, that theology, and so that's going to create a lot of problems, and that's the source of all of the persecutions of Athanasius, because the emperor was the one that was exiling him. So, just to back up a little bit too, just to mention that when Constantine exiled Athanasius back in 335, it wasn't because he was absolutely convinced that Constantine deserved it. It was more of an undecided thing, where the Council of Tyre did condemn him and said, "You're guilty," but Constantine wasn't convinced that the council was fair. He saw that they had an agenda and that they were out to get Constantine. But then at the last minute, the enemies of Athanasius came up with another charge, and that was the one that Constantine said, "Okay." So he just decided to exile Athanasius to sort of get him out of the way and try to reduce the controversy. But it wasn't because Constantine was saying, "I'm convinced that you're guilty." So what that leads to is this sort of ambiguous situation. Is Athanasius truly condemned or not? And that's going to create all these problems after Constantine dies and the other emperors come along, and they're going to say, "Well, we need to reinstate the condemnation of Athanasius." So, what happens is Constantine dies in 337. After the death of Constantine, Athanasius ends his first exile and returns back to Alexandria. Yeah, Jeff?
Do we know what he did while he was in France?
No, not really. Don't know the details. No, not in jail. So, in these exiles, you were free to live and so on and do various activities, but you couldn't, if you're a bishop, you weren't able to exercise any of your functions as a bishop, and you weren't allowed to be in the physical location of your bishopric. You couldn't be there physically.
And for other exiles, that's why, for instance, in the East, in Arabia, there's a lot of heresies there. Mm-hmm. It's because that's where, if you got exiled from the empire, heresy.
Right.
That's
where you leave the empire.
So who
right.
Muhammad run into?
Yeah.
Well, it's all a bunch of heretics.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
That's right. Yeah. So after Constantine dies, again, because his condemnation was ambiguous, the condemnation of Athanasius was ambiguous, he was able to return, but it wasn't clear if he was really being vindicated or what. So he just returns to Alexandria. And there's another quiet period. So the second quiet period lasts from 337 to 339. It's a little more than a year long. Then in 339 to 346, we have the second exile. Now this exile happens under Constantius, the son of Constantine. In this exile, Athanasius was in Rome, and he was there for about 7 years. We know a little bit more about what happened during that exile. How did this happen? Well, Eusebius of Nicomedia, the archenemy of Athanasius, he has the ear of Constantine's son, Constantius. He's right there in the imperial capital and the palace and all that. And so he's the one talking to Constantius and saying, "Athanasius is a bad guy. You need to renew the exile that your father first imposed. You need to accept the decision of the Council of Tyre," which Constantine did not accept, but Constantius was convinced to accept it, and so this is what causes the second exile. At this time, there is an individual named Gregory who is, quote-unquote, intruded to become the bishop of Alexandria instead of Athanasius. This word intruded means somebody from the outside being forced upon that city. It wasn't that the people themselves and all the priests and the deacons said, "We want this person. We know who this person is. We want this person to be our bishop." It was just being forced upon them from the outside by the imperial authority. And so Athanasius was forced to flee to Rome, where he had allies. And his main ally there was the Bishop of Rome, whose name was Julius. A lot of times when you're reading these church histories, they'll refer to the Bishop of Rome as the Pope. But at this point in time, I don't use that term because all of the connotations that we have in mind of what the Pope is are a little bit later when you get into the Middle Ages. At this point, he's just the Bishop of Rome, a very important bishop, one of the five important sees, like Arthur just said, but still only the Bishop of Rome, not universal jurisdiction over the entire church.
Made him the bigwig, that was the capital of the empire.
Right,
so
yeah.
He was
The Roman Catholic Church would say that the thing that makes the Bishop of Rome so important is not because it's the political center, the capital of the Roman Empire, although actually at this time it wasn't. The capital was Nicomedia and Trier. But the reason that the Roman Catholic Church gives is that that's where Peter and Paul were martyred and have their bones. So they claim that that's the basis of making Rome such an important bishopric. But at this point, we're just talking about the Bishop of Rome. His name is Julius, and Julius was in favor of the Nicene Creed. He was opposed to the Arians, so he was an ally of Athanasius. So while Athanasius is there in Rome, he presents the whole case. And we have all the documents, too. If you're interested, you can read them all. All the documents that Athanasius presented to the Bishop of Rome to clear himself, as well as a very nice long letter by Julius, the Bishop of Rome, clearing Athanasius and saying all these charges are false. And also, Julius was very fair, and he invited the accusers of Athanasius to come to Rome and present their case before a church council, but they refused to come. So that's what's going on in Rome. Now, interestingly here, I mentioned before that Eusebius of Nicomedia dies in the year 341. And he's replaced by a new guy who takes his place as the leader of the Arian faction. His name is Achacius of Caesarea. Even the name kind of sounds a little bit foreboding, right? Achacius. He, like his predecessor, has the ear of Constantius. He was nicknamed the One-Eyed. Monophthalmos in Greek. Mono and then ophthalmos. Why? Maybe because he literally only had one eye, but also he was kind of this shifty, clever character, and you were never quite sure what he was saying. He had a very sharp intellect, though, and he was called the tongue of the Arians. He rejected the Nicene Creed, just like Eusebius of Nicomedia. He was very clever, though, because he didn't come right out and say, oh, I'm a heretic. What he did is he said, we should reject the Nicene Creed because it uses the word homoousios of the same substance, and the word homoousios is not found in the Bible. So we want to be biblical and get rid of these extra-biblical terms that are being foisted upon the church and that are only causing more controversy and dissension in the church. And so because he feigned this piety of saying we want to be biblical, he was able to write creeds that sounded orthodox but didn't have the word homoousios in them, and that was what enabled him to get the support of other bishops who themselves were not Arians but who were sympathetic and were able to sign those creeds and gave the Arians more strength politically than they deserved. And that's really kind of an interesting history to all this, where that group, the ones that were orthodox but sort of ended up voting with the Arians, after a while they realized that they were being duped and they went back and said, okay, we accept the Nicene Creed. But that happens later. That happens in the 350s and 60s. There was also a council in the year 343 called the Council of Sirdica or Sardica. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. Today we would call it Sofia, which is the capital of Bulgaria. I don't know if you're familiar with that city, but that's modern-day Sofia. The Council of Sirdica was requested by Julius, the Bishop of Rome, because he wanted to vindicate Athanasius. And so that council was held, and it did actually vindicate Athanasius. In the year 346, his exile comes to an end because Constans, remember there's two sons of Constantine at this time, Constantius the Arian and Constans, who's a Nicene fellow. Constans uses his pressure as one of the co-emperors to get Constantius to end Athanasius's second exile. And so Athanasius returns to Alexandria in the year 346. Again, just think of it as being like the Pope coming to America. Just crowds of people, they're rejoicing to have their bishop back, to get rid of that guy Gregory who was enforced upon them. You know, all the city goes out to meet him. And this leads then to the third quiet period, which lasts for 9 years, from 346 to 356. It's called the Golden Decade, because this was the time when Athanasius, he's in his prime. By now he's in his, basically his 50s, and he has great success in re-establishing the Church of Alexandria, in getting the Arian bishops replaced by Nicene bishops, and just really establishing himself as a pastor of that flock. Great things are happening in the congregation itself. However, outside of Alexandria, it's not so golden, because during this decade, from 346 to 356, there are some really dark clouds that are forming on the horizon. And what are those dark clouds? Well, in the year 350, Constans, remember, he's Athanasius' ally, he's a Nicene emperor, the younger brother of Constantius, he was assassinated during the rebellion of Magnentius in the year 350. Magnentius was basically one of his underlings, maybe a general or something, and there was an uprising within his own army to get rid of Constans, and Constans was killed. He was assassinated. Remember, last week I gave you a picture of a coin that had the Cairo on the back? That was the coin of Magnentius. So Magnentius was trying to curry favor with the Christians, to say, I'm going to be on your side and support you. And so that's why he put the Cairo, the X and the R, which looks like a P, right on top of it, to symbolize those are the first two letters of Christos, of Christ, in Greek. And so he was trying to use that as a way to get support. So, unfortunately, these are the dark clouds that are forming. Already, Constans is dead. Then you have 352, another ally of Athanasius, Julius, the Bishop of Rome. He dies. He was succeeded by a new bishop named Liberius, who was also technically Nicene and held to the Nicene Creed, but he was very weak-willed. He was not a strong defender of it. And so at first, Constantius exiled him because of it. But then after a while, he couldn't take it anymore, so he caved. And he said, okay, I'll sign your Arian Creed. And he was reinstated back to be the Bishop of Rome on the condition that he would accept Arianism. So you see how Arius's friends are starting to fall. In the year 353, remember Magnentius, who rebelled against Constans and tried to create his own, tried to make himself a usurper, that is, a pretended emperor. He was having these battles with Constantius, and Constantius defeated him. And in 353, Magnentius committed suicide. And so now, in the year 353, Constantius, who's a committed Arian, is the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. Constans is dead. Julius is dead. It's just Constantius. So now, for the next 8 years, from 353 until Constantius dies of a fever in 361, Constantius is the sole emperor, and this is the darkest period of time for the Orthodox. During this time, this is when Jerome made that statement, that he said, the whole world groaned to find itself Arian, because things are really getting bad now, especially because of Constantius being the sole emperor. In the year 353, Constantius begins the process of trying to get Athanasius. So he holds a synod in Arles and another one in 355 in Milan, and both of these synods condemned Athanasius, reiterating the condemnation of the Council of Tyre way back in 335. Basically saying that Athanasius can no longer be a bishop, basically trying to depose him from the office of bishop. So this leads then to the third exile in the year 356. After condemning him, what does that mean? Well, now the emperor is going to send his troops down there to Alexandria and say, Athanasius, you have to get out. So in the year 356, General Syrianus storms the church where Athanasius is holding a worship service during the worship service to try to arrest Athanasius. Athanasius escaped, and he flees into the desert with his monks. One thing to understand at this time is that monasticism is developing at this time. Now, it's not quite the way we think of it. We think of in the Middle Ages, we think of monks and monasteries and stuff. That's sort of a later development. At this time, in the 4th century, it's more a form of asceticism, where holy men would say, I'm not going to get married. I'm just going to wander out in the desert and pray and get close to God.
So they weren't organized.
They were less organized. There were some attempts to organize them in little, they're called cenobitic asceticism, where they would live in little communities. But don't think of these as being super rich monasteries like you have in Europe, okay? These are just, you know, 20 ascetics living in caves or living in some shack somewhere, you know, and they would live together. But you have these ascetics all throughout the Egyptian desert. The most famous one was Saint Anthony. Saint Anthony was the most famous ascetic that Athanasius even wrote a biography of. And the biography that Athanasius wrote of Saint Anthony was instrumental later on in the conversion of Augustine. Augustine read that, and God used it to convert him. So all of these monks living in the desert, sometimes they're just living in caves by themselves, sometimes they live in little communities, but they're all over the place in the desert. So this is where Athanasius goes. He flees into the desert and just goes from one place to the next. Meanwhile, the armies are chasing him, and he just moves on from one place to the next, and the monks hide him. And he just lives that way for 6 years in the Egyptian desert. Just as before, remember in his second exile, there was a guy named Gregory who was intruded to be the bishop instead of Athanasius. Same thing happens here. A fellow named George, quote-unquote, the monster from Cappadocia. That's what he was called. He was an Arian. He was intruded to be the bishop of Alexandria. This exile, the third exile, was the most productive for Athanasius' ministry because he wrote half of his treatises during this time. So there he is, running from the armies, going from one little group of monks to the next in the desert, and he's writing all these treatises against Arianism. Then in the year 361, Constantius, the evil emperor who was an Arian, dies. He dies of a fever. And a relative of his named Julian, he's called the apostate because Julian was raised as a Christian, but he converted back to paganism as an adult, actually as a young man. And he decided that he was no longer a Christian and wanted to revive the ancient pagan Greek gods, Greek and Roman gods, and say that we need to worship them and we need to turn the clock back. After Constantine converted to Christianity and society was beginning to become more Christianized, not entirely, there were still a lot of pagans around, but it was still moving in that direction, and Julian the apostate says, no, we need to turn the clock back and go back to the way it was before. So he tries to revive paganism, and in fact, he used the church and the way the church was organized with bishops and so on as a model to create his own pagan churches, where they would have their own pagan ceremonies and rituals and bishops and so on. He even wrote a book, one of the most famous attacks on Christianity. I forget the title of the book, but he calls the Christians the Galileans. That's his term for them. He kind of fancied himself as a philosopher, like a Platonic philosopher. And so most of the emperors up to this time, like Constantine and Constantius, they were Christians, and so they were clean-shaven. If you look at all the coins and the busts and so on, they're clean-shaven. But Julian the Apostate grows a beard like a philosopher. And you can see on his coins, he's trying to say, look, we need to go back to pagan philosophy and pagan worship. Now, Julian, in 362, he issues an edict of clemency permitting all the bishops that had been exiled under the previous two emperors to return to their bishoprics. And you might think, wait a minute, he's a pagan. Why is he allowing this to happen? Well, he's very clever. His thinking is, maybe if we let all the exiled bishops come back, then the Christians will fight each other even more with their debates over Arianism versus Trinitarianism, and then the church will destroy itself from within. That's what he's hoping. So Athanasius, he takes this opportunity. The Edict of Clemency was issued. Athanasius, oh, okay. So he goes back from his exile, and he comes back into the city. Again, the same thing. The whole city goes out to meet him. The people come from all over the country to meet Athanasius, whom they now regard as a saint, as a holy man, as a great man, and they love him, and they just, you know, welcome him with open arms. Yes, Pastor Jeff.
When he's in exile, is somebody else appointed as bishop, or are they just bishopless?
Remember I mentioned the intruded guys? So there's, at this time, the intruded guy was George the Monster from Cappadocia.
So he was, what happens when he comes back? He just boots him out?
Actually, with George, the funny thing about George is, I don't know the reason why, but for some reason he was hated by the populace, and the pagans killed him. There was a riot, and they just killed him, got rid of him. So fortunately, Athanasius didn't have to do anything. He just came right back and went right back into his office. This leads to the fourth quiet period, but it's a very short one. It only lasts 8 months. Reason is that Julian changes his mind and says, you know what, Athanasius, I wasn't intending to include you in that edict of return. You're the exception, so I want you to go back into exile. All the people are clamoring for Athanasius to engage in civil disobedience and resist the edict of Julian the Apostate, the emperor. And Athanasius says no. He urges the people to submit, and he predicts that this exile would be brief. And he must have been a prophet because he was right. Because in the year 363, Julian, the emperor, was killed in a battle with the Persians. The Persians are over there in the far east area. They've been all during this time, the Persians are the biggest enemy of the Roman Empire. And there's always all this friction between the Persians and the Romans. And Julian, he's thinking that he's ushering this new era of the Roman Empire returning to its pagan roots. He thinks, I'm going to go to Persia and deal with Persia once for all. And that's going to be the end of it. But he ends up getting killed in the battle. And so the army elects Jovian to be the emperor in place of Julian. And Jovian holds to the Nicene Creed. And so Jovian becomes emperor. And Jovian is favorable to Athanasius and reinstates him back to his see as the bishop of Alexandria. So that brings us then to the fifth quiet period. Unfortunately, this is also very brief, about a year. But it's an important time of quiet because in the year 363, and we'll talk about this more next week, Athanasius holds a council in Alexandria that for the first time officially affirms the deity of the Holy Spirit. And this will be taken up later at the Council of Constantinople in 381. But Athanasius was the first one to really endorse that and make it clear, saying that the homoousion, saying that, the Son is of the same essence as the Father, applies to the Spirit too. The Spirit is also homoousion. So all three are of the same essence, the same divine nature. In the year 364, unfortunately, Jovian, the new emperor, who's a Nicene Christian, he himself dies after serving as emperor for only 8 months. And this then leads to a new, renewed period of conflict in the church and state, because now to replace Jovian, there come two emperors, Valentinian, who holds to the Nicene Creed, and Valens, who's an Arian. And they become co-emperors, Valentinian in the west and Valens in the east. I think they were brothers. So this leads then to the fifth exile of Athanasius under Valens in the year 365. By this point, it's almost like anybody who becomes emperor, first thing they got to do is exile Athanasius, right? That's like the first thing on the to-do list, right? So Valens does his duty and exiles Athanasius once again.
How do I know I'm emperor?
Yeah.
Send Athanasius away.
But by this time, Athanasius has built up such a base of support in the city of Alexandria that basically this is just going to cause a riot And so Valens sort of realizes that, and he backs off. And 4 months later, he takes it back and says, okay, just go back there and just be bishop, and let's just ignore it. So that's the end of it. That's the last exile of Athanasius, and he spends the rest of his life until his death in his sixth quiet period, which lasted for 7 years. By the way, that fifth exile, when he was exiled, he didn't even leave the city. He kind of knew, right? So he just hid in his father's tomb on the outskirts of the city of Alexandria for 4 months. Just kind of waited for things to quiet down, and then he came back. In this final and sixth quiet period, which lasted for 7 years, there's one really important event that takes place, and that is in the year 367. He issues what's called the 39th Festal Letter. So every Easter, the bishop would write a letter to his congregation to let them know when to celebrate Easter that year, right? Because when do you celebrate Easter? Well, it's based on the Jewish calendar, right? Because you got to figure out when is the Passover and all that. And so it's the Sunday after Passover. So it's a complicated process that, I mean, in our day, it happens automatically. They just put it on the calendar. But in their day, they had to have people figure it out. So they wrote these letters called festal letters. And they would take this as an opportunity to not only tell them when to celebrate Easter, but also to encourage the flock on, you know, as a pastor and so on. So in this 39th festal letter, obviously he had 38 other ones right before, but in this 39th one, something really important is found in that letter. And that is, for the first time, we have the list of the 27 books of the New Testament that corresponds exactly with our list today. Up until this time, there were, you know, everybody agreed on the four Gospels, everybody agreed on, you know, the letters of Paul, but there were some debates about other letters like Hebrews and 2 Peter and Revelation and things like that. But finally, in the year 367, it seems to be that things have settled down, and this is the final decision, the final agreement. On. It's not that Athanasius was saying, this is the decision, I'm rendering the decision. It's just that this is what the church believed. So that becomes an important marker for us in church history. Now, I mentioned that these two emperors, co-emperors, one of them was an Arian, Valens, and he was a bad guy, just like Constantius. He also persecuted the Nicene Christians. He banished all the Nicene bishops, and he begins another wave of persecution. And this wave of persecution in the 360s is so bad that it causes all the Christians to say, man, this feels like the way things used to be back when the emperors were pagan, right? Back in the persecution of the pagan emperors in 303 and so on. So this is a time of great suffering for the church, especially for the Orthodox Christians. Then in the year 373, Athanasius dies. He appointed one of his own presbyters to be a successor. He dies quietly in his own bed, surrounded by his supporters. He died 8 years before the Council of Constantinople in 381, which is kind of sad because that means that all of his life's labor, he didn't really get to see the final fruit of it, because it's in 381 that the church finally gets all this controversy that's been going on since the Council of Nicaea for 56 years is finally ended, and the church just says, okay, we believe in the Trinity now, and the Arians sort of fade away from history at that point. So he didn't get to see the full fruit of his ministry and his labors and what he had fought for all his life. But he was already beginning to see the little beginnings of it. And we'll talk about that more next week. So as you've been able to detect already, Athanasius was the victim of a conspiracy, basically. And it's called the Arian Conspiracy. It was hatched by Eusebius of Nicomedia, and it was taken over by Achaicus of Caesarea. It was an intentional campaign after the Council of Nicaea, 325, to try to get rid of all of the enemies of Arianism. And the plan was to go around and target all the key bishops that are staunchly Orthodox and to accuse them on two counts. One, some kind of moral charge, or ethical charge, or something about how they were conducting themselves as pastors, and two, on a theological heresy, which usually was the heresy of modalism. Modalism is the doctrine that there's just one person within the being of God, And this one person manifests himself, you know, maybe in the Old Testament as the Father, and then in the New Testament as the Son, and then in the Church Age as the Spirit, but it's just one person. And that heresy of modalism was condemned long ago, back in the 3rd century, but the Arians accused the Orthodox Nicene people of being modalists. And so they used that as their wedge. And so the proof that it wasn't just Athanasius is that there were other bishops too that suffered the same fate. There was a bishop in Antioch named Eustathius who was deposed and exiled in the year 330. There was a guy named Marcellus of Ancyra who was deposed and exiled in 336. And in fact, remember during the exile where Athanasius was in Rome? Guess who he met there in Rome? Some of these other bishops. Marcellus was one of them. And they were there talking to the bishop of Rome and complaining about all the stuff that was going on and how these Eastern bishops were being kicked out of their sees by these Arians. So that was the plan, to basically overturn the Council of Nicaea by attacking the Nicene bishops, the ones that were the most staunch advocates of the Homoousion creed, or the Homoousion phrase. What were the charges that they brought against Athanasius? Well, it was moral and ethical issues. They didn't really focus too much on the modalism charge. That was more for Marcellus of Ancyra, who might have actually been a modalist to some extent. But with Athanasius, they brought up all these issues of integrity. I'll just list off some of the charges. Number one, they accused him of murdering another bishop named Arsenius, and then cutting off his hand and using the dead man's hand as a tool for sorcery. This charge was completely false, because at one of the councils, and there were all these different councils that were trying to meet to condemn Athanasius, but at one of them, Athanasius actually had his supporters go and find the guy. He was actually alive, hidden in a monastery somewhere. They pulled him out of the monastery, brought him to the council, and said, "Here he is." And he admitted, "Yeah, it's me." And then he had his hands hidden behind his back, and he said, "Let's see if his right hand is missing." Pulls it out, it's not missing. "Let's see if his left hand is missing." Pulls it out, it's not missing. "Does he have three hands?" You know. But anyway, they proved that that charge was completely fabricated and false. Another one that they brought up was that Athanasius was committing treason by threatening to stop the grain shipments to Constantinople. Remember, Egypt was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. That's where all the grain was grown. And so Constantinople didn't have any grain, so they got all their grain shipments from Egypt. And since Athanasius is the big man of Alexandria, right? He's the bishop, he has all this power, they accused him of literally trying to stop the grain shipments to Constantinople, the capital, in order to get his way so that he could be reinstated as bishop. That was false. Athanasius said, "Look, I don't have that much power." You know, there was actually a secular governor of the city who had more power than he did. Another accusation they brought up against him was that his election as a bishop was illegitimate. And the reason why, they said, is that according to the canons of the church, you have to be a minimum of 30 years old to be a bishop. But when he was ordained as a bishop, he was right around that age, and so they brought up the claim maybe he wasn't 30 yet. That's why there's debate over when he was born. Remember, I said some say 296, 297, 298, because that's part of the controversy. The truth is, he probably was exactly 30. And so that's what gave some leverage to his enemies. They also claimed that he was elected and consecrated as a bishop by a small group of bishops who supported him, and it was done in private. And that's probably not true, although there might have been some legitimacy to it because of the fact that he was reluctant, and so they had to do it hastily. But he was definitely supported by the Church of Alexandria. In fact, his predecessor, the bishop of Alexandria before him, Alexander, he was the one, before he died, he said, "I want Athanasius to be my successor." So it was legitimate. But they had, you know, these little things where they could bring up doubts and so on. They just came up with one charge after another. If that one wouldn't stick, they'd try a new one. But there was one charge that they brought up that did have some degree of legitimacy, and that was they claimed that he used violence to persecute the militians. Remember I mentioned before that the reason why Athanasius was reluctant to become the bishop was because he knew that that church was full of controversy, not only with Arius, but also with this other sect called the Miletians. The Miletian schism happened in the Church of Alexandria over the question of what do you do with someone who, remember the persecutions before Constantine was converted, the Roman Empire was persecuting Christianity and, you know, killing people, throwing them in prison, all kinds of stuff. Well, what do you do if a Christian caves under pressure during the persecution, goes ahead and throws a pinch of incense into the image of the to the fire at the image of the emperor, and then later on says, I repent, and wants to be restored to the church? Well, the Miletian schism wanted to have very strict terms. In fact, they basically wanted to say you couldn't be restored. And the mainline church, the traditional Roman Catholic Church, said, no, we think you can be restored if you're repentant. And so that created a schism. They had their own bishop named Miletius, who was the bishop of Lycopolis in Egypt. And he formed his own schismatic church with his own ordinations, his own bishops, his own priests, his own everything, kind of like a separate church that was doing everything that the rest of the church was doing. So this Miletian schism was a problem in the Church of Alexandria. In fact, it was such a big deal that at the Council of Nicaea, way back in 325, they had to address it. And the church council decided that they would allow those Miletian people to be a part of the church as long as they didn't continue ordaining new people. But after the Council of Nicaea, they broke the agreement, and the Miletians started doing more ordinations and being more schismatic. And so Athanasius had to deal with this group in his church, and he did things that were a little bit heavy-handed to try to stop them. Now, the Miletians, who by this time are now buddy buds with the Arians, Eusebius of Nicomedia sees that they're the enemies of Athanasius, so they get together in cahoots and they formed an alliance, and they claimed that Athanasius had sent one of his supporters to go to a service of the church of the Miletians, a Eucharistic service with a Miletian priest doing communion, and that this supporter of Athanasius went into the service and he overturned the altar and he burned a book and he broke the Holy Eucharistic chalice. And so that's sacrilege. And so this was the main charge. This was the charge that they brought up back at the Council of Tyre. And this was the main charge that kept sticking against Athanasius throughout his whole life. Athanasius deals with this. He wrote a whole book defending himself, and he says, first of all, the guy that was performing the service that day wasn't even ordained, even in the Miletian church. He was not a validly ordained presbyter or priest. Secondly, that guy himself was on his sickbed, and he was not celebrating the Eucharist, and it was a weekday, and so it wasn't Sunday, so it couldn't have been the Eucharist. So Athanasius is responding to the charge in a way that almost sounds like he's admitting that something happened, right? But yet saying it's not sacrilege. And so this is the one charge that has the most validity, although the way in which his enemies are presenting it is probably skewed and not accurate. But it does have some validity that he had to deal with these schismatics who were acting totally out of control, violating the councils of the of Nicaea and not submitting to the bishop. And so he was kind of forced to be a little bit heavy-handed to get them under control. So that's the one black mark against Athanasius. Now it's important to realize here that the Emperor Constantius had a huge role to play in all of this. It wasn't just Eusebius of Nicomedia and Achacius of Caesarea. They wouldn't have gotten very far if they didn't have the support of the emperor. Athanasius himself put it this way in his book called The History of the Arians. He said, "This heresy has come forth upon the earth like some great monster, which not only injures the innocent with words as with teeth, but it has also hired the external power to assist it in its designs." So by that he means the emperor. It has hired the external power of Constantius to be the force driving it. So they were the ones whispering into the emperor's ear all these evil things and all these charges, but it was the emperor who was doing the exiling and imposing these outside guys like Gregory and George and intruding them into the church and so on. And sending in the army that one day. Remember when Athanasius is doing the worship service, sending in the army to get him. Constantius bullied several church councils to get them to condemn Athanasius. So the Council of Arles in 353 and Milan in 355, they were both councils of Western bishops. Western bishops are pro-Athanasius. Western bishops are pro-Nicene Creed. But somehow Constantius bullied them and intimidated them to force them to condemn Athanasius. He threatened that anyone who refused to condemn Athanasius would be exiled and possibly even put to death. During his reign, especially that period of time after the Magnentian usurpation is put down, so from 353 to 361, that last 8 years, when things were so bad, he did a lot of crazy things. He meddled in the affairs of the church directly to force his Arian theology upon the church. He convened a whole slew of church councils and told them to write creeds that would be replacements for the Nicene Creed. These creeds were very cleverly written to sound orthodox. If I were to read them to you today, you would say, that sounds okay to me. I don't see the heresy there. But you have to understand that they're carefully splitting words and parsing things precisely to make it sound okay, so that the orthodox would be tempted to sign these things and that the Arians would then be able to say, well, we can sign it too. Gregory Nazianzen, who was later on, he said that they used orthodox-sounding phrases as a bait to the simple, concealing the hook of impiety. And all of these councils and all the creeds that they wrote have been pretty much forgotten. We still have the texts because they were quoted by other church fathers and saying, look how bad this is, so we can piece it together. But they've all been forgotten. Church history has sort of flushed this whole period of time down the history, down the collective memory has just been gone, and we don't believe in these anymore. That's why the Council of Constantinople was so important in 381, because it reaffirmed Nicaea in 325, where in between you had all these false creeds that didn't believe in the homoousios phrase. So Constantius then is remembered by the church as a wicked emperor who used his awesome imperial power to impose the heresy of Arianism on the church. What about Athanasius as a man? The thing that stands out most about him is his character. And what do you see just listening to the story? The main thing you see is a man who is just absolutely resolute and uncompromising in standing for the truth. Unlike, let's say, Pope Liberius, Bishop Liberius. He held to the Nicene Creed, but then he caved, and he ended up signing. And there were others, too, like this. It's a sad thing in the history of the church. Orthodox, godly men. There's even one story of an old, ancient, 90-year-old bishop named Hosius. Remember, he was the one that presided at the Council of Nicaea in 325. But in his old age, in his 90s, he was pressured to sign one of these false Arian creeds, and he did. Even though he didn't really believe it, but he did because of the pressure, because of the politics and the emperor having so much power. But Athanasius did not, and he withstood it, and he went through five exiles because of it. He saw the fundamental theological issues clearly. However, like all great men, you think of great men like Paul and Luther and Calvin, that very strength also has a downside to it. And so there are certain aspects of Athanasius' character that come across as being a little bit abrasive. If you read his writings, he uses invective against the Arians that's just a little over the top and kind of ad hominem, to be honest. He calls them Ariomaniacs. he says that they're authors of blasphemy, foes of God, harbingers of the Antichrist, which actually you could see that might be true, right? I mean, in 1 John chapter 2, what is the Antichrist? It's those that deny the Father and the Son. So you can see how it's not completely wrong, but at the same time, you just kind of wish that he hadn't been so harsh with his terms. Probably the worst one was he said they were dissolute and effeminate men. He called them godless atheists, and he even called them Jews, which, again, it kind of makes sense if you think, right, Jews don't believe, they're not Christians, not Messianic Jews, they don't believe in the deity of Christ, right? So you could see how it would make sense to call them Jews, but at the same time, it's just not really appropriate. So those are the downsides. So there's that one mark against him for using force to suppress the Milesian sect, and then there's also his language and the ad hominem attacks. But he was a godly man, and for those that did know him, they said he had a pastor's heart, that he was gentle, free from anger. These are the words of Gregory Nazianzen. He was sympathetic, sweet in his words, sweeter in disposition, that even when he rebuked you, he did it in a calm and fatherly way. He had a pastor's heart, too. Remember that story that I mentioned very briefly at the beginning of his third exile, when the governor came in and stormed the church during the worship service? He, you know, had a pastor's heart because he was concerned about his flock. There they are in the worship service. It's at night. The governor has 5,000 men with, you know, swords and spears and bows and arrows and everything, and they're surrounding the church. And at one point, they start breaking down the doors and going into the congregation. And Athanasius said, I want the people to be safe first. So he went up onto his episcopal throne. He sat there in the back of the building, and he had a deacon read one of the Psalms, and he asked the congregation to recite, "The mercy of the Lord endures forever," after each verse. And that kind of calmed the congregation. It gave them some time, and he told the people to file out. And pretty much all the congregation got out, and they were coming for Athanasius. At the last minute, his own monks kind of gathered him together, hid him under their cloaks, and smuggled him out into the darkness of the night.
Sort of like but Luther.
Yeah, exactly, like Luther. So, but that just shows you his heart. He was more concerned about the people than he was about himself. He wanted them to be safe. He said, it'd be better if I got hurt than for the people to be hurt. And then just to conclude there, I have some quotes that I've put in the handout. These are just a little taste so you can see what kind of a person he was as a theologian. You can read those at your own leisure, but these are just some great quotes that really help to clarify the deity of Christ. The main thing that you want to really focus on here is that he's really emphasizing the distinction between what does it mean to say that Christ is the Son of God versus saying that he is a creature of God. That's what Arius would say. And so, remember in the Nicene Creed, it even says he's begotten, not made. That's just another way of saying he's the Son. He's not a creature. How does he relate to the Father? Does he relate to the Father the same way all creatures relate to the Father, that we're just created, that one day we didn't exist and now we exist and we're just creatures? Is that who he is? Is he just a creature? No, he's not just a creature. He's the Son. He's begotten, not made. Seeing him as the Son gives you a whole different idea of who he is. It shows you that he is all that the Father is, because he is the Father's Son. He's the eternal Son of the Father. If you say that the Son, if you say like Arius said, that there was a time when the Son did not exist, then logically you're saying there was a time when the Father was not a Father. And so he takes page after page after page to explore this distinction between begotten versus made, Son versus creature. But he just goes around it from all different angles and different ways of thinking and dealing with all the exegetical arguments and the verses. His writings are very exegetical, just dealing with verse after verse after verse. He'll even take a verse that the Arians would use, and he'll spend 50 pages answering their interpretation of it and going around and around and dealing with how do you explain this text. And so that's his whole heart, his whole passion, is to see that Christ really is the Son of God. If you really think about what that means, that he is the Son of God, okay? If you really meditate on that and dwell upon it and plumb the depths of it, there's no way you can say he's a creature. And so if you understand that, that necessarily leads you to see that he is homoousios with the Father. He has the same nature, the same essence as the Father. That's what it means to be the Son, that he has the same essence as the Father.
I have a question, though. Actually, isn't in Christ one of his natures? He is a creature by one of his natures. And that's why it's appropriate to him to worship the Father.
Right, if you're talking about as the incarnate Son.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I'm not talking about...
As the incarnate Son, yes, his human nature is created. But that's after we've already established that according to his pre-incarnate state as the Son, he's not a creature. But then at some point, he takes a human nature, which is created, into union with himself. And it's in that human nature that he suffers, dies for our sins, and all that.
For all of us. He does this stuff that other people used to say. See, he's just a creature.
Right.
Well, no, he is a creature, and so it's appropriate for him to pray to the Father, worship the Father, and so forth. But he's not just a creature.
Exactly. So. Yeah, that's the key. Just to conclude with three little phrases from Gregory Nazianzen again. Gregory Nazianzen, I kept quoting from him. He wrote a kind of like a eulogy for Athanasius. It was about 7 years after Athanasius had died, around the time of the Council of Constantinople. Gregory Nazianzen was one of the three Cappadocian fathers. We'll talk about them next week. They were the ones who sort of took up the torch after Athanasius died and really helped the church to understand the Trinity. So Gregory Nazianzen wrote this eulogy called the Oration on Athanasius, and he said a couple of things about Athanasius that I thought were really helpful, just little phrases to describe him. He said, he was a man of God and a mighty trumpet of truth. He was the pillar of the church, and he was the noble champion of the word. And by the word, he doesn't mean the scriptures. He means the second person of the Trinity, the Logos. In the beginning was the word. He was the noble champion of the word. When all the world was groaning to find itself Arian, and all these emperors who were Arian were persecuting the Orthodox, he stood firm. And thanks to him, thanks to his courage in standing up against that Arian conspiracy and the power of the emperor, to a large extent, we can thank him that it was because he did that that we today have this inheritance of holding to the Nicene Creed and holding to the doctrine of the Trinity and the deity of Christ because of his faithfulness. So let's pray. Thank you, Father, for giving us this chance to study the life of this great servant of God. And we pray that you would help us to appreciate how you, in your providence, use this man as a servant, as an instrument, to preserve the truth of the gospel and the truth of who Christ is for the generations to follow. And we ask that you would help us, too, in some small way, to have the same courage that he did in standing for the truth. We thank you in Jesus' name.